Malcolm to Educators Who Dare to Lead. I have a question for you, Tabitha. When were you being the most courageous as an educator professional, and what did that feel like for you?
Oh my goodness, loaded question to lead us out today. So I think probably, you know, thinking back about the times that I've been the most courageous, it's always going to have to do with answering a tough question or facing a difficult situation where other people have expected something from me. So in education, like as a teacher and as an administrator, I'm thinking specifically of times when I had to be accountable and answer for student data, and when there were people over me or above me or even alongside me saying, hey, let's look at your scores. Why aren't they where they need to be? And what are we going to do about it? So being faced with an obstacle and having to take ownership of it and think through, what am I going to do to improve the situation? Those are the times where I've had, where I think that I have felt like the most scared and also needed to be the most courageous. What about you?
I mean, it was a great question listening to you answer it. And now I'm like, oh, why did I ask that?
Why did we even start with this?
When I have stood on solid ground for what I believed in, takes the most courage. It is so much easier for me to stand up on that solid ground for someone else. But what has taken the most courage is standing up for myself. Particularly, I have this kind of like trigger, this desire to be cooperative or to be somebody that gets along with everybody. So if I can tell that I have a need to move to a different grade band or a different team or a different content or whatever, instead of just saying yes to whatever I know will be the most helpful, to actually say, I have a preference and it is for me, not for someone else. And my preference is this, and it's actually contrary to what someone expects or wants of me. That is very difficult, and it takes a lot of courage. What inspires me to do it is that when I have made that active choice to stand up for myself, it has almost always allowed me to have a stronger sense of success. And by success, I don't mean like data and numbers. I mean like the sense of accomplishment, the sense of being beneficial to the people I serve. That just takes a lot of courage to say no.
It does. I think that's a lesson that I am still learning in life. I think it's hard for a lot of people. Yes. Well, I am Tabitha.
And I'm Elizabeth.
And we're making this podcast for any of our educator friends who are wanting to know more about the book Dare to Lead by Brené Brown. And we're looking at it through the lens of education. So whatever aspect of education you're involved in, a teacher, an instructional coach, an administrator, however you're involved in education, we want to see what Brené has to say about daring to lead and what it means to us in the field of education. Between us, we've got 30 years of experience in education. We've both served in a variety of roles, from teacher to administrator to instructional coach to a teacher trainer. If you want to dig in deep with some educators on the practical impact of Dare to Lead, then this podcast is for you. Please stay with us.
We want to meet everyone where they are, so we will always give you a synopsis of the chapter or the section that we're doing in each episode. If you're using the episode as a preview, as a review, or maybe just as your introduction to the book, we'll have that synopsis. So here's the synopsis of the book. Brené tells us about her journey, how her previous books, Rising Strong and Daring Greatly, are the theory of her research. But this book, Dare to Lead, is taking all of those theoretical ideas and putting them into a practical playbook. One of the most important pieces in the introduction is she defines a leader as someone who takes responsibility for finding the potential in people and processes and who has the courage to develop that potential. I literally had chills as I read that, because who else does this so impactfully more than educators?
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody out there has an alternative, but I am going to stick with educators since
we're a little biased.
A little biased, yeah. In each one of these sections, we're talking about the introduction today. We're going to talk about an impactful piece or quote, the one thing that we cannot leave this episode without talking about. The quote that she quotes by Marcus Aurelius, which until we did this episode, I always attributed to Brené Brown. So if you see this attributed to Brené Brown, that's incorrect. It's actually Marcus Aurelius. It is, what stands in the way becomes the way. That quote has helped me find simple solutions to the most frustrating, complex, annoying problems, whether it's with people or technology or anything. I just stop and I say, well, this is my problem. And then I think, okay, so what in that problem could help me find the solution? And it almost always does. Like, I'll say, ah, I wish that OneNote had a landing page. Well, I could just create a landing page and a OneNote page. That definition is amazing to me, or that quote, what stands in the way becomes the way, has changed my life. What about you, Tabitha?
I love that. The thing that stood out to me was, and this is a Brené Brown quote, she says, the true underlying obstacle to brave leadership is how we respond to our fear. More chills, right?
Yeah.
So I think this really spoke to me, because there have been times in my life where I have been really focused on changing my emotions rather than figuring out how to respond to them, you know, and that was not the right approach to the problem. It's not about eliminating our fear. It's not about putting ourselves in situations where our fear doesn't exist. It's about thinking through, how are we going to respond to it? We don't have control over other people. There are a lot of situations and circumstances that we don't have control over, but what we do have control over is our response to them. So this was just really powerful to me. So thinking through, not, okay, I'm gonna scrap my fear. I'm gonna throw it away. It's not going to exist anymore. But thinking about, how am I going to use it? How am I going to respond to it in this situation?
Wow. I'm just letting that wash over me, because I'm thinking about our students and their fears. Whether you have adult students and you're a trainer, thinking about how we have students that are fearful to get up in front of people, whether it's a performance for the arts or a speech or to take a test or even to sometimes vocalize that they have a need,
yeah,
or even to be wrong.
Yeah. And I think something that we face so often as teachers is how to reach the whole child, and not just, are we teaching them the academic lessons, but are we teaching them the life skills, the social and emotional lessons that they need to learn? And I think that this really plays right into that as well, is teaching them how do you deal with fear? How do you deal with the strong emotions and the big feelings that come up? So powerful.
Yeah. And not, the point is not to be, is not to say, don't be afraid. There's nothing to fear. That's not what we want to say. We want to say, you feel fear because your body is preparing you for this big moment. and then helping them move past that or respond to that.
Yeah. And I think that fits right in with your quote too, Liz, because what is it that stands in our way sometimes? It's our fear. And what do we need to do about it? We need to figure out how we're going to respond to that and how that becomes our path through it, not around it, not over it, not under it. You remember that going on a bear hunt?
I was like, where is that from? And I was like, I'm going to start singing it. Yeah. But also like prepositions from teaching middle school ELA grammar, trying to teach prepositional phrases. And let's take a break. I think
all right. We'll be back in just a minute.
All right.
All right. We are going to jump into the introduction today and talk specifically about how what she says in her introduction can apply to educators. What Brené does first is talk about the behaviors that get in the way of being a courageous leader. So we're going to go over, we'll list all of these 10 behaviors for you, and then we'll go back through and talk about what we've seen in the field of education. So the first thing she says that gets in the way of being a courageous leader is a fear of conflict in crucial conversations.
Sorry, keep going.
Yes, I think we could just even stop right there and be like, yeah, that gets in the way without even anything else on the list. Avoiding those tough conversations and those confrontations, giving honest and effective feedback, that is huge and it's difficult. Then a lack of empathy and candidness, especially during major change. We all know how, unsettling things can be when there's change going on and your foundation doesn't feel firm, and just being able to manage problematic behaviors and acknowledge and address those fears and feelings that show up during change and upheaval. Yeah. Taking the forethought to do that, not having the forethought to do that, since these are the things that get in the way. Another one is a general lack of care and connection. And that is huge on a personal level, just not having that trust built between you and your whoever it is that you are leading or that you are working together with. A lack of innovation is another obstacle. So when you don't have people that are taking smart risks or creating and sharing those bold ideas, that's huge. We need that. We need that injection of creativity and not being afraid to step up. A culture of blaming rather than regrouping and finding a solution. So, focusing on setbacks and disappointments and failures and not being able to see beyond them and just placing more importance on figuring out who you should blame rather than figuring out how to fix the problem going forward. Mm-hmm. And that's only half of them. We've got more to go.
So those are the first five on Brené's book. So a lot of that was word for word. You improvised a little bit, but just giving credit where credit is due there. The other five on Brené's list of behaviors that get in the way of being a courageous leader or courageous educator are, number six, invulnerability. This presence where you are not taking ownership or accountability, and this either unwillingness or just blindsidedness so that you cannot learn from mistakes. Number seven, privileged, that's either unacknowledged, especially around diversity and inclusivity. She said that comfort is not as important as having hard and painful conversations. This quote has rocked my world, especially in June of 2020. Choosing our own comfort over having hard conversations is the epitome of privilege, and it corrodes trust and moves us away from meaningful and lasting change. That has just really been in my heart. It has challenged and inspired me to get a little bit outside my comfort zone, both in myself and also how I interact with other people. Mm-hmm. 8, incompetence. When something goes wrong, this is really making me think. Not knowing how to handle things when things go wrong. I love this. Just trying to go, okay, how can we fix this now? And just going to the easiest, fastest solution to get the problem to go away. That is definitely a problem I can relate to and is frustrating, and that I believe I have probably done at some point in my life and frustrated others. 9, lack of attention to results and measurements. We can have unclear values. We don't really know where we stand on things. Maybe what we hope to achieve is so unattainable, you can't ever achieve it, and therefore it has no real meaning. You don't have a measurement for that. So one, my measurement is that I am home during this podcast, and sometimes my dog is there. I think this is really important, definitely in education. Any interview you've ever been on as an educator, somebody, whether it's you or them, is going to say data, 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 right? Because we talk about it so much. So the fact that this is on her list is very important to educators, that we do not get away with a lack of attention to results and measurement, that those are important and we treat them as so. 10, perfectionism. Perfectionism that leads to a fixed mindset, which is so interesting because I have known so many perfectionist educators.
Yeah.
And as educators, we're supposed to, at least right now in 2020, it is still a very big push to teach our children how to have a growth mindset. But it is so hard. Sometimes we want to be a perfectionist at having a growth mindset, and it just is not working because it discourages and devalues learning and growth, is what she said. So Tabitha, of those 10 items, what have you noticed? So 1, fear of conflict and crucial conversations. 2, a lack of empathy and candidness. 3, a general lack of care and connection. 4, no innovation. 5, a culture of blaming rather than regrouping and finding a solution. 6, invulnerability. 7, privilege unacknowledged. 8, incompetence when things go wrong. 9, lack of attention to results and measurements. And 10, perfectionism. What do you see in education?
Can I just say that I have seen them all? I don't really want to pick just one. There are things, as I was reading through the introduction, there were things about my experience in education that I found that applied to every single one of these. I want to probably start with the last one, though.
Okay.
That good perfectionism. Choice. Yeah, because what you were talking about, I think, is really huge in education right now, the idea of having a growth mindset and creating that environment for students to have that growth mindset as well. When for some reason, it really does seem like this field attracts people whose personality types are more a little bit more type A or perfectionist. And I know that I don't speak for every teacher or everyone in education. I know there are plenty of you out there who don't struggle with this. And if you're one of those people, we need you because we need support in overcoming this in ourselves. But I think that's really huge of figuring out how we as teachers can be okay with our own mistakes and our own failures, and using that to model for our students how to recover and how to come back from that, and just showing that it's okay, that you don't have to be perfect all the time, that you don't have to always get it right. I think it's good for our own personal growth, but it is huge for the students in our classroom that are looking up to us.
The big three that I see, number one, I'm going to start with fear of conflict and crucial conversations. Mm-hmm. And that to me directly connects with perfectionisms. As a teacher, I think that you need to have the tough skin of like a struggling Broadway artist. You are going to get criticism from 360 degrees.
Yeah.
Your parents, your students, your principals, the public, your teachers, and most of all, yourself. Mm-hmm. All of that feedback, as Brené says, armoring up to protect ourselves from all of that criticism is what I think leads, maybe not that teaching attracts, they become perfectionists because of all of that conflict. And so then it becomes, how do I avoid the conflict at all costs?
Yeah.
You have to hold the idea in your heart that your worth is not your work, that your profession as an educator is not your worth. You are a human being that has worth beyond your test score, beyond how many parents write you nasty grams, or beyond what your principal thinks about you. And we'll get into, as we go through, a lot of our stories about how we have found better fits for ourselves when things like that happen. But those two things are at the top of my list, and they are deeply connected. The third one on my list is privilege that is unacknowledged, especially around diversity and inclusivity. And that is also tied to those things, because if you are teaching in a particular environment where if you talk about diversity and inclusion in such a way, you are going to really anger some of those stakeholders that are constantly telling you how much worth you have, then it is very difficult to be courageous to have those talks, knowing that those people are going to be that are going to respond in that way. Or it's the fear of, okay, I want to talk about this, but I'm going to get it wrong. I'm going to make somebody mad. And I think it goes back to the fear talk that you brought up earlier. That's not the goal.
Yeah.
You have to accept that you will get it wrong when you talk about privilege and inclusivity and diversity. The goal is not to get it right the first time around. The goal is to be courageous and open to it and acknowledge it and have those hard, painful conversations so that progress can be made and we have more acknowledged privilege, which means we have better diversity and inclusivity. But that is so much easier said than done. And depending on the environment around you, that is harder to make happen. If most of the people around you are like, no, things are fine. it's hard to be like the one that's going, hang on a minute. So those are the ones that I've really seen.
Yeah. And going back to that quote by Brené that you said first time around with privilege.
The epitome one?
Yeah. Like choosing our own comfort over hard conversations is the epitome of privilege. Mm-hmm. And just recognizing that, just being able to recognize that and do the hard work that mm-hmm. it is to learn more about other people's experiences that are different mm-hmm. than your own, and recognizing that. We are also reading a book for work, How to Teach Students Who Don't Look Like You. And yes. I think this is huge. It's just the starting point. Like, it is just the tip of the iceberg for, I think, people who are wanting to recognize and mm-hmm. make sure they're owning up to their own worldview and what they bring into the classroom. Mm-hmm. Because you can't avoid it. You can't just say, okay, drop your worldview at the door. You can't expect your students to do that. And you can't do that yourself as a teacher. So you have to be able to, you know, be willing to face it head on and bring it into the room and acknowledge your experience and how it affects the way that you view the world and really think through the different experiences of each of your students and how it's affecting how they're viewing the world. I mean, that's huge. That is so big in education. And this is where it starts. We in education, like, we're the ones doing foundational work on what's going to happen in our mm-hmm. country in the future.
Definitely. So what do we do about that? What do we do about these 10 behaviors? Does she have any answers for us, Tabitha?
Oh my goodness. Thankfully.
Thank you. Can't just leave us, Brenee.
Thankfully, she does. And we are going to take a look at the things that she suggests that we do right after this break. All right. So we have heard so far about the 10 behaviors that we want to avoid. And thankfully, that is not where we have to stay. We are going to move on, focusing on the negative and focus on the positive. So Brené Brown gives us 3 courageous behaviors that we can and should do in order to be brave leaders. So
like that's 3 more than 10. Like 3 I can do instead of 10 that I have to like try and eliminate. Like, I can eliminate 10 with 3. I'm good. Thanks, Brené.
Exactly. So we are going to spend a little bit of time with each one of those. And these are coming directly out of her book, out of the introduction. So the first one is, you can't get to courage without rumbling with vulnerability. Embrace the suck.
Oh man, it's kind of like the thing you said with the fear and the uh-huh. quote that I had, like, the only way out is through. You can't get through one to the other.
Yeah, they go hand in hand, right? She says right underneath that in her book, courage and fear are not mutually exclusive. So I think sometimes, you know, we have been brought up to think like courage is the absence of fear.
Right.
In order to be brave and courageous, that means that we just don't have fear at all. And that's not what it's about. So courage and fear are often present at the same exact time within us. We have to be brave yet vulnerable at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the phrase embrace the suck?
It, to me, it just kind of goes along with accepting the fact that things aren't always going to be rosy.
Well, she doesn't say accept the suck. She says embrace the suck. So brace comes, I think, from like the Latin word of arms.
Uh-huh.
So you got to wrap your arms around the suck. And I know she uses language so powerfully. She uses a word like suck. And every now and then, I don't know about in her book, but in her TED Talks and some other things, she'll use some she'll use some curse words here and there. She's really great at using language in such a way to get you to have that like strong immediate reaction. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I would say suck, especially for what I'm thinking when I say this word, but embrace the difficulty Yeah. So not accept it, embrace it. What does that mean to you?
I'm glad you pointed that out, because it definitely has a different connotation. And I think it's so funny that we keep going back to the same two quotes that we mentioned right at the beginning of the episode, because that's embracing it makes me think of, you know, the only way out is through, or whatever the obstacle in your path becomes the path. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this is not pushing it off to the side or trying to avoid it, but it's using it. You're embracing it. You're using it in order to become better and stronger, mm-hmm. instead of becoming better and stronger in spite of it.
I'm thinking about roles that we serve, where we serve others, whether you are an educator serving students who are adult or kids, or a principal serving teachers, or a coach serving teachers. This idea of embrace the difficulty, which I'm going to use because I'm talking about humans, so I just do not want to use the word suck. Love you, Brene, but I'm just going to take some liberty here. In our role as coaches that we have served in the past, we were assigned, which means that the teachers did not choose and they did not always embrace us.
Yeah.
But what I found to be true and inspiring is that the teachers that struggled the most with accepting the fact that, yes, they did have a coach and they did have to attend these meetings were the ones I learned the most from. They were the ones that sharpened my pedagogy, that sharpened my content knowledge, because I always had to be almost over the top prepared, not perfectionist. I had to be to work on that a little bit, because that was the tendency too, right? Like, I'm going to be so good, they can't find anything wrong. They are going to find stuff wrong.
Yeah.
But I found three things. Number one, that I learned so much from the teachers that I was better able, even if that one teacher never bought into anything I was trying to help them with, that the ideas that I would prepare, because I would really have to just constantly think like, well, what if they don't like this idea? Or what if, okay, last time they told me this, like I would have to be so attuned to that I was better able to serve all of the other people I was serving, because I would just have to think about things in a different way. And even if they didn't like it, I was able to adapt it for somebody else. So it just increased the value that I could bring to other people. The second thing was, if I would just keep showing up with quality and keep showing up with a real listening ear, and I would never step off of my solid ground, that I was here to support them and add value and leave the defensive state at the door. Almost every single one by the end of the year had some kind of comment for me, like, I really did not want to do this and I am so glad that I did, or I got real value out of this. It just takes time. Not everybody's going to be there at once. So if you are an administrator or you're a coach, or you are a teacher and you are serving people that you are not their jam, embrace the difficulty, because it will make you better able to serve other people. Not if you just get your armor up. That is not what I'm saying at all. Like, you have to listen to them and be like, what is this person in my life to teach me? What can I learn from them? How can the experience and the practice of, and we'll talk later in the book about leaning into your values, leaning into my values, help me better serve everybody. The third thing is, often when or if you win these folks over, their influence, whether they have the title that they're supposed to have influence or not, is just like this force multiplier that impacts the culture everywhere. Like, this person that just could not say enough negative things about you or your role or whatever you're there trying to do, all of a sudden is like for you, and they are vulnerable and courageous enough to admit that they had changed their mind. It's it has the potential to turn around a whole school culture. So to me, that phrase, embrace the suck or the difficulty, is how can this teach me more about what I'm here to do?
Yeah, I think as I think back on all my different experiences and my different jobs, the ones where I walked away with the most personal growth and the most learning about myself were the ones that were the hardest, right? The ones that I had to embrace something really difficult. Mm. Yeah. And so true. All of that that you said, I agree wholeheartedly. I want to go to the phrase that she uses here.
Okay.
Rumbling with vulnerability, because I think that deserves a little bit of
telling you language, man.
Diving in, right?
He's a researcher, but yes, like, oh so, man.
Yeah, the rumbling. Very first thing that it made me think of was The Outsiders. Did you ever teach that novel in middle school?
No.
Oh my goodness.
I'm aware of it. I think I read it. I have seen bits of the movie. Tell me more.
Okay, so in that book, they refer to rumbles, like the different groups of friends or the different gangs or, you know, the different sets of people when they're going to have a fight. Okay, they call it a rumble. Like, we're going to rumble.
Are you ready to rumble?
Yeah, basically.
Come on. You know, if you were listening, you were thinking about that.
So that's what the image that came to my mind when I hear the word rumbling. And so as I'm thinking about how do I rumble with vulnerability, that's what I'm thinking through, is how do you wrestle with it? How do you know, cause I got that image of kind of like the fight and, yeah, how do you work through it? Because it's tough. And so she goes on to explain, because she does have to define it for us. And I want to read her definition.
Go for it.
Because I think it's so powerful. A rumble is a discussion, conversation, or meeting defined by a commitment to lean into vulnerability, to stay curious and generous, to stick with the messy middle of problem identification and solving, to take a break and circle back when necessary, to be fearless in owning our parts, and as psychologist Harriet Lerner teaches, to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
Impossible.
That's so
much.
I don't
speak French, so I don't think I said it right, but it's so hard to do this. How do you have any tips or tricks for listening with as much passion as you want to be heard?
Tips or tricks, man.
what do you tell yourself when you're in one of those conversations?
I think what it goes back to is what she says also in this definition, stick with the messy middle of problem identification and solving. So when I'm listening, when I'm in a difficult conversation and I want to make sure that I am listening with passion, with intent, then what I'm listening for is the root of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, here's what this person is telling me. Is that the real problem, or is it just another symptom of something deeper? Is it something on the periphery that, and we still need to dig in a little bit deeper? So I think for me, being able to listen with that passion is listen with the intent of digging deep and asking questions and getting to the root of the problem rather than saying, you're frustrated about making your students take this test. Mm-hmm. Well, then let's talk about the test. You know, like perhaps there's something a little bit more. So rather than just trying to solve the surface problem or being reactionary and dealing with this in the moment, but then not being prepared if it comes up in the future, I think that's what it is for me, is trying to dig deep. And so listening, but following up with more questions before you follow up with any sort of advice or problem solving. What do you think?
We put a lot of pressure on ourselves to know what to answer. Because that was always what I thought when I would hear that. Celeste Headlee has a fantastic TED Talk that's 10 Ways to Have a Better Conversation, I think is what it's called. And she talks about that. And everybody has heard this quote. But like so many other things, we tell people what not to do without telling them what to do instead. Mm-hmm. My thought was, okay, but what am I going to say when they stop talking?
Yes.
Like, I won't know what to say if I've not thought of what to say. And I don't want to say the first thing that pops in my head because I am I have a kind of a reaction personality. So I kind of think about people being processors where you need to give them space to process and then they can respond. And then I don't know if reaction is the right person, but I am more of an in the moment kind of a person. But what if my in the momentness is not good? So I want to be thoughtful and have time to think. But if we say that the what's in the way becomes the way, then maybe it is not that we have to pressure ourselves in the first place to come up with a response. Mm-hmm. Maybe we ask a question. So having some off-the-cuff questions that we can lean into, a few of them. Tell me more is not a question, but that's a statement that we use. Okay, tell me more. What does that feel like for you? Mm-hmm. What else? Mm-hmm. And even asking what else a couple of times to where you don't have the pressure to ask that. And usually I struggle. And then if I can just get to that first, what else, or tell me more, then I can usually relax a little bit. The other thing is I used to take notes. Some people have asked, well, can you share your notes with me? Because then that makes them nervous. And I'm like, yeah, I'll share my notes with you. But I'll take notes on what they're saying because it forces my brain to focus on that. And then also because I am slower at writing than at speaking, I would be like writing it up and thinking about what I was going to say. And they would fill the silence with the thing they really needed to say in the first place. And I was like, whoa, this is magic. And then it was a lot more comfortable to have those conversations because I didn't have so much pressure on my shoulders to think of the beautiful, insightful thing to say, especially as somebody that's serving somebody else, because you have walked into the room, whether it's, you know, a Zoom room or a brick and mortar kind of space, with everybody kind of expecting you to have some kind of answer to solve this problem. If you're a teacher, an administrator, a coach, or someone else, you're serving someone, they're going to tell you the problem and you're supposed to be able to get you both to some kind of acceptable solution. That is a lot of pressure, especially when you don't know how they're going to be like mad or what. But just making space for them to say what they're going to say, listening to what they're saying, which sometimes people don't get a lot of people in their lives that actually listen to what they say, and then pausing and letting them fill in some awkward space. Those things have helped me the most.
And circling back, you don't have to have the right answer. And I tend to be more of a processor. Like, it takes me some time to think through before I feel like I have a solid response that is worthy of, you know, other people listening or paying attention to. So a lot of times when I've been working with teachers, after I listen, then I say, okay, I'm going to keep thinking about this.
That's a good one.
I'm keeping it in mind and I'm going to get back to you. And I've come back, you know, after meetings with teachers and sent them follow-up emails and said, okay, even a week later and saying, oh, remember that conversation we had last week? Well, I read an article that applies that I think fits in really well. So giving yourself that space to not have the answer in the moment, if you have that trust built up that, hey, I am listening and I will follow up with you, then it doesn't, not everything has to get resolved in one conversation.
Will also help your meetings be shorter.
Yeah.
Because you can always say, like, you know, I heard you bring up three things. I think in our meeting, we can definitely address one of them and maybe follow up with the other two, you know, via email or set up another time, which is the most important to you, and letting them bring that in. So again, you don't have the pressure to solve everything that's put in front of you.
And that works with students too, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And it gives them a model for when they need to have conversations on, like, what are some things they've heard other people say? Like, how can they ask for what they need so that they don't get so emotionally overwhelmed when their needs aren't being met and they don't have a method to ask for help because they've seen you do it. Mm-hmm. I love the phrase circle back, and also that you use circle back and she used circle back. Mm-hmm. I think it's hilarious, all the memes that were like, who knew I was married to a circle back person. Because there's two things I love about the idea of rumbling. Number one, she used the progressive tense with the ing of this is an ongoing thing. So when people are talking about being woke, I don't like the idea of being woke, but I like the idea of waking. Mm. Because it's a process. It's ongoing.
Yeah.
There is no definite end. It is something that will continue.
Yeah. It's not like one day you just have arrived and there you go. You're set for the rest of your life.
I rumbled, done. That was the end of it. Because and when I think of rumble, I don't know why, but I think of tumbleweed, and I think it's just because it's rhymes and that's just silly. But I think about your belly rumbling. Like, it's the process of, like, something going like this, right?
Yeah.
Which is like your words and my words and your words and my words, which nobody can see because we're in Zoom, but I'm kind of wrapping my hands one over another.
Yes, there are hand motions involved.
Oh, no. So not only is she using a verb that kind of means to, like, circle over back and forth, as that's how I view it, but she also has this progressive tense on there, ing, that it's going, because there's two things when you have a rumble or a rumbling conversation. One is that you guys are both contributing something, and that's this back and forth. You're going to say something, you're going to listen to something. Your words are going to affect you and them. Their words are going to affect them and you. But the other piece is the whole conversation that happens after the conversation. The way that conversation is perceived a week later, when they have a conversation with someone else about your conversation, or just in the moment, the impact is not over. I felt this a lot with teachers that I served and with students, where you would say something and you would be like, I did not get through to them.
Yeah.
The change that they said they wanted, that I was trying to help them reach. We could have just not had that conversation at all. And then something else will happen and you'll see a change, but you didn't have a new conversation. And it's because people change when they're ready to change, and you can inspire people, but you cannot judge the effectiveness of that rumble in the moment of the rumble.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it just, the conversation and the impact of it just keeps going.
So many ties to being a teacher to students there, but also being a parent. That's kind of where my mind kept going here too, is not just dealing with other people's kids, but dealing with your own kids.
So what else do you have to, you can't get to courage without rumbling with vulnerability?
I think that's about it. I think we talked a lot. I mean, there's more we could say, but to sum it up, to put a bow on it.
To circle back.
To circle back.
It's not what circle back means, but I couldn't resist.
I think I would just go back to what she explains at the beginning, is that courage and fear are not mutually exclusive. So they're going to be together. They're going to go hand in hand. And that's what this whole idea means to me.
I have a nuanced question for you. Mm. Let's say if you are a teacher or you are serving teachers and you want to be a courageous educator, you want to be an educator who dares to lead. How do you know when something is worth the rumble and when something is just an issue that needs space?
Oh, man. That's the question, isn't it? Because if you face everything as a difficult conversation, no matter how small, if you come into it saying, all right, I'm going to brace myself, I'm going to mm-hmm. be vulnerable, I'm going to have courage, we're going to deal with this. If you do that for every single little thing,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be exhausted and it's not going to be as effective, mm-hmm. I wouldn't think. It's kind of like that, choose your battles wisely. Mm-hmm. Choose your rumbles wisely. So how do you decide
mm-hmm.
which ones are worth it? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. That I'm posing to you to solve.
Let me just solve all the world's problems with this one answer. Man, how do you know?
I think you don't know, but you take, so if the only way out is through, I'm going to say this quote like so many times an episode that.
Yeah. Like you can tell we each have our own favorite quotes and we just keep saying them over and over again.
Okay. So you don't have to know. You have to listen. And yeah. I think you have to give space and be like, well, that was an interesting experience, and give space and see what that person does on their own first, depending on what the issue is. Like if it's obviously, if you're talking about behavior that is just counter to the ethics or the values of your school or the people that you're serving. If you've got, you know, some of the issues that she talked about earlier, going back up to the quote, where you've got racism, classism, sexism, or manifestation of fear-based leadership, I think that is kind of the non-nuance. That is the issue where there needs to be a rumble, but you might pause and just say, like, you know, what happened in there, and let them show you if they get it. And if they get it, say, well, what can you do to heal? Or to help, you know, what can we do about that? I don't know the perfect question, but to kind of just put the feeler out there to allow that person, if they have realized they've messed up, to, if you can see from what they've shown you in the past, it was really like not characteristic, and you can tell that they can handle themselves well, let them handle it, or say like, how can I support you as you repair the situation? If it's like people aren't getting along, or there's something where it's not such a big deal, I think you look for patterns. You look for patterns of dysfunction. And you go back up to your three things. What did you say? Three behaviors that encourage courage, and you go to your 10 behaviors that get in the way, and you kind of look for, is this a one-off, or is this a pattern, and how destructive is the pattern? And I think you look for that big picture, because if you're always having uncomfortable conversations, people cannot rest, and if they can't rest, they can't process. If they can't process, they can't heal.
Yeah.
And it's, depending on your school, you'll have to make that decision for yourself or your classroom. You don't want things so confrontational that people can't be vulnerable, because they have to have, they're like, they walk into right. your classroom and they're tense because they're like, oh gosh, what are we going to talk about today? that I don't. And you also, I think, have to help people. You have to give them the tools and the support to handle this stuff. Mm-hmm. You can't just be like, all right, we're going to have this and you're talking and nobody else really gets to say that's not rumbling with vulnerability in my limited opinion.
Yeah.
I would love to hear from people that are listening. So if you have some ideas of what works, please let us know on our Facebook page and we'll give that to you at the end of the episode. What else? Anything else with rumbling with vulnerability or the nuance of when to rumble and when to pause?
I think the good thing is that this is still the introduction. So we're going to get to dig in even more because we do. Like there is still a lot more that we could talk about with this. So I think we can leave it for now with yes. the anticipation that we will revisit it.
I just saw that the next episode is on part one, rumbling with vulnerability. So we'll give us some answers there. Okay. Number two, behavior. Self-awareness and self-love matter. Who we are is how we lead. It reminds me of the quote, the thing that people would say, like, you can't love anybody until you love yourself, which mm-hmm. I think is flawed. But this matters. And I think it ties so closely to perfectionism mm-hmm. that your worth as a educator, as a human, is not a test score. It's not the number of parents who approve you or any number or metric or anything else. And it's not all you are. I have this huge belief, and this is from Brené. I did not believe this until I had really started digging in, her and Amy Poehler, that people are doing the best that they can. And if you were like, uh-huh. no, they're not, just hang on for the ride. It's up to you if you believe this or not. But the thing that changed my mind with this is they're doing the best they can in life. You don't know why they're not growing in thing A. It could be because they have had a significant trauma in their life and kind of just not tuning in to thing A is a way they cope with that trauma. Mm-hmm. So allowing that understanding has allowed me to accept that about myself, that I am doing the best I can in life. And the things that I really think that, like, if I would just do this, I could be so much better, or I'm just not good at this and I'm letting everybody down, or all those things that I tell myself, to stop and realize that I am telling myself that, which means I am in control, which means I can stop it, which means that I can turn this around. And the other thing was the idea that good leaders are self-aware and like themselves. And so I was like, if I want to be a better leader, I have to like myself. Like, it was like, I don't know how to explain it. It's all, again, I keep saying, like, I don't like perfectionism, but then I'm like, I hear myself saying yeah. something perfectionist. But it was, oh, I want to get better at this thing. I'm going to focus on this thing. And in order to get better, it means that I have to like myself and be self-aware. Okay, let me dig into the work now.
Yeah. But doing it, you had to have that permission to do that.
Yes. And it's almost like I'm doing this for my professional career. So it's like doing this for others in a certain way.
Yeah.
It means back to the beginning thing where I was saying, if I'm doing it for myself, I feel like it's selfish and I can't do it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But if I do it for my career and so that I can serve others better, it's like, oh, I have to be more self-aware, in the same way I would say, like, oh, I need to go to, you know, I need to get better at my executive presence or my communication skills or something.
Right. Yeah.
It's bizarre. And it's also profoundly absurd that we don't like ourselves. Mm-hmm. But that's also like super universal. I don't know why that's so difficult for people not to like themselves, but my goodness, who else is going to like you more than yourself? Like, why can't you be your own friend? Why can't you be like, you know what? I like myself and I would want to be my friend. I would never treat a friend the way that I have historically taught myself in the past. It makes no sense. Why wouldn't I want to be kind to myself? Also, as people that serve other people, especially small humans, i.e. children, being a model of someone that is A, self-aware, and B, likes themselves, is vitally important that they see that. Those are my thoughts. What are your thoughts? We're getting a little deep here.
I know. I think what you said about treating yourself the way that you would treat your friends, that's what really stood out to me as I was thinking about this. Is there are so many things that I say to myself that I would never say to you or to one of my other friends or to my own children. I'm way harder on myself than I am on other people. And if I can give other people compassion and grace for their imperfections, then I need to remember to do that for myself as well. And it also makes it so much easier to care for other people when you have taken care of yourself.
One of the big moments in my life, sorry, again, the dog. She thinks she's being courageous, but it's just a squirrel. So I have the hardest time with giving myself, with being kind to myself when it comes to being a mom, and definitely as a teacher, and that got better over time. But the thing that has helped me most with being a mom, and this is can be used for teaching too, is that you are modeling what this role looks like to children, to peers, to people that are new in the role. And how do you want their experience to be? I was crushed when I thought that the kind of modelhood that I am, the kind of motherhood that I am modeling for my children is one that is like self-loathsome and just wrought with stress and frustration. And it was this breakthrough moment where it's like, I don't want them to have, if they choose to be a mother or a parent or to, you know, whether it's from the spouse perspective or their perspective or wherever they go when it's that time of their life or don't go, I don't want them to think that that's how it's supposed to be, that that's the normal way we go about this, that it's so stressful. And, you know, and I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And again, it goes back to that. It's so much easier to do things for other people than for ourselves. So if you're a teacher or if you are a corporate trainer or anything like that, you can think about like all of these kids that might dream of being a teacher. They see me as a model of what that means. And how do I want them to experience it? Mm-hmm.
Something else that stood out to me with this section is when she says, fear is the emotion at the center of that list of problematic behaviors and culture issues. So when we look at people's behaviors that we don't appreciate or don't like or don't want, instead of just trying to modify that behavior, what is so much more important is to go underneath that behavior to find out the cause and to recognize how much of it is based in fear. So I think a lot of self-awareness and self-love has to do with understanding fear. fear and what triggers fear in yourself and how you respond to that fear. And again, especially when you're working with students and with children and young adults, being able to model that for them is so huge.
And it segues nicely into her third behavior,
which is courage is courageous.
Contagious.
Ah! Okay. Scratch that. Rewind. Which brings us to the third. Courage is contagious.
A two. Very good.
So,
good kind of contagious.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. What do you have to say about courage is contagious, Elizabeth?
I think we really talked about that in the last one, where it is when people have a model and an example, whether you know it or not, they take that with you. You may never even know that. We hear that all the time. But I was in a group, and most of them kind of had a worldview that was different than mine, and I felt very alone in the group. And then I was talking to one of them as an individual, and it turns out that, oh, like, we saw a lot of things eye to eye. And it's not important that we saw things eye to eye, but the point is that we kind of see things as, like, this group of people feels this way because a few people are speaking out. And you can't assume that that is how everybody feels. It kind of reminds me of fisheye teaching in a classroom. You can't assume that because four kids can give you a correct answer that the other 20 understand. You can't assume that because four teachers voice a certain perspective that all of your teachers feel that way, or that all of your coworkers feel that way, and to assume that you're the only one that is ready to be courageous or that is ready to stand up in a courageous way. Maybe they just need someone else to take that first step. And once they see someone else take that first step, it makes it so much easier for other people to do that. And I'm not a psychologist, but I can think of like 10 different examples. Like when I have a friend that always wants to sign up for 5Ks, and I'm like, I don't run. I just like, you don't understand. That is not something I do. And then she like kept encouraging me to do it. And I love 5Ks, and I hated, I mean, the worst day of the year in elementary school was when we had to run the mile.
Run the mile. Yep.
So worst day. And when you're trying to get healthier, if you have a friend that is willing to go healthy with you, it is so much easier to take that courageous step to say, I'm going to do this for myself. And it is like, I want a bowl of ice cream with chocolate syrup on it so bad, but the only way out is through. So this is like one evening, and tomorrow morning when I wake up, I will not regret that I didn't have that bowl of processed sugar that is terrible for me. And also I'm lactose intolerant, so that's not good either. But we can't assume that we're alone in our values and what we know is right. We can only see what we see. So I love data. So if you are in a room with 100 teachers and five of them say something that you are really concerned about as far as how we're treating students or what is going on in a school culture, that's all you have. You only see 5 out of 100. That is a very small percentage, but maybe those five are like super vocal. So I think it's kind of important to realize that we can't, when we step up, that actually you become another data point. That now it's five people, you know, stand up for one way, and we've got one person standing up for that, and that can inspire somebody else to stand up or to take action. And I can think of examples where I didn't have a lot of, I want to say currency or clout, whatever you want to call it. I was kind of new to a school and I was like, I don't understand why we're doing it this way, because I feel like the students need an authentic experience in this other thing. But I could not stand up. But when another teacher did, then I could stand up. So courage is contagious, whether it is, you know, like, you know, your standards and the standards are not being met and you want to speak to that, or you want to speak to having real data, or maybe it's a cultural issue to address that by having courage and showing courage, you will inspire others. And that may help you be more courageous. And your students will see that too.
And I think this book is called Dare to Lead. And some people who are listening might say, okay, well, I'm a teacher. I lead the students in my classroom. But other than that, you know, I'm not a lead teacher. I'm not a principal. I'm not an instructional coach. I'm not an administrator. So that's where my leadership ends, is outside my classroom door. And I think that this right here speaks to the fact that that is not reality, because you don't have to have a title to be a leader.
Absolutely.
All you need is to follow these principles and be courageous, cultivate that positive, safe culture. And people will gravitate to that and they will follow it, and you'll find yourself in a place of influence, whether or not you have the word lead next to your title, you know?
And if you have things to value, to be courageous, to step into those roles, if they fit what you want out of your life, that it's pretty profound in educate, or prolific in education, to have the imposter syndrome as you step into a new role. Realize that's universal, that every principal and every educational leader you've ever met doesn't have 100% of what they need to be in that role, because there's no such thing, because that goes back to perfectionism, which is not helpful. So if you are like, man, I've got my, I really want to go back to school and get my education leadership, but I'm no whatever, fill in the blank of your favorite principal there, you don't have to be that person. You have something else unique to add to leadership. And if you are embracing this book and embracing the principles of it, then yeah, education definitely needs more leaders like you. So be courageous in the role that you're in. Be courageous enough to step into other roles if they are beneficial for you. There's definitely something to be said for being courageous to say no when things are too much as well. But actually, Brené has a specific message for being courageous for teachers. And I'm going to read that now. It's kind of a long quote, so stick with us, process it, and we will process it, because we can't speak to the full implications yet. It's quite a message. What we can do and what we are ethically called to do is create a space in our schools and classrooms where all students can walk in and, for that day or hour, take off the crushing weight of their armor, hang it on a rack, and open their hearts to truly being seen. We must be the guardians of a space that allows students to breathe and be curious and explore the world and be who they are without suffocation. They deserve one place where they can rumble with vulnerability and their hearts can exhale. And what I know from the research is we should never underestimate the benefit to a child of having a place to belong, even one where they can take off their armor. It can and often does change the trajectory of their life. If the culture in our school, organization, place of worship, or even family requires armor because of issues like racism, classism, sexism, or any manifestation of fear-based leadership, we can't expect wholehearted engagement.
Pause for processing. So what is your response to this quote, Liz?
I remember reading the quote and being like, yes, say it, Brené. We need more of this in our school. And just automatically including myself in the group that does all these things. And I'm reading this out loud. This is June 2020 when we're recording this. And I had read kind of the beginning. I had read the end and I knew that the middle was good. But we are just weeks away from an event that it's I don't know why it was just one event, but has just rocked our country and the language that she's using in this, where students can breathe, mm-hmm. where they can be who they are without suffocation, mm-hmm. where their hearts can exhale. And where it can change the trajectory of their life. It's like, how did she know? And she follows that up immediately with talking about not having racism, classism, sexism, or fear-based leadership. And we have a gentleman who was murdered through not being able to breathe. It's just, it's incredible. Like, does she have a crystal ball? How did she know? And I don't mean to joke with this at all. In any way, but there's that the language is so powerful, and we can definitely relate to this, to what's going on right now. I identify as a white person, so reading this is, I think, a really great place for me to dig in, and I'm excited to dig in, and I have that fear, and that is what she's telling us is okay. When I read this the first time, just automatically, I'm a good person. I don't view this. I view this, and I'm, you know, I made these specific choices and raised my children in this specific way because I believe in what she's saying. And then when we were writing this podcast and we got to this quote and we recognized the importance of this quote and we struggled hard trying to figure out what to say, we finally got to the point where we were like, knowing what to say is not the important thing. And that is in of itself kind of what she was saying, is the epitome of privilege is feeling like you can wait until you know what to say. I know I have personal work to do, and I know I have a strong desire to be wholehearted. And that's going to take being open to what other people who identify as a different race or a different class or a different sex or any of those other categories might say to me, that even in the best of my intentions and even in the way that I've really thought about putting myself out there and getting it right, that I'll still get it wrong. And I have to be open to what they have to say and listen and take that into my heart and be aware that it's okay to be wrong. That being right isn't the point of this. It's having the conversation, and it's being courageous to say, I don't know.
Yeah. And taking responsibility to learn what you don't know.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think what stands out to me going back over this, and you're right, we've thought about this, we've gone over it so much, and we've talked in circles to try to figure out how to address it. But mm-hmm. looking back at what she says about creating that space for students to take off the crushing weight of their armor, mm-hmm. I think a big part of it right now is recognizing that is a privilege to be able to take off your armor. Mm-hmm. That's a privilege. that we take for granted, I think. And I also am a white woman, so I have grown up with a very different worldview and life experience than people of color. So when I read something like take off your armor and feel safe, and then I'm like, okay, I think I can do that. And just recognizing that asking students for that is huge. That is not easy for everyone. That is not to be taken lightly. And just realizing that your life experiences and your worldview and all of the baggage that you carry along with you influences so much of how you do things in your own classroom.
Yeah.
And just continuously being aware of that and monitoring it and evaluating it and checking yourself and making sure that you are doing what you can to learn about the experiences that your students are facing and what their families have faced in the past. It is huge. So,
you know, there are the bigger issues, especially because of where we are right now, and it should be all the time, but it's, I think, in the forefront of everybody's mind. But even let's say that things took a beautiful turn and we were able to live in a world without racism, classism, sexism. There's still fear-based leadership to deal with. And when we are working with, if you're in educational leadership, if you're dealing with teachers, or if you are a teacher and you're dealing with students or parents, one thing to help you take off your armor is remember that they are bringing in a ton of experience that they had before you ever entered their life. And that might be that they had some fear-based interactions with their past teachers, or maybe they just weren't listened to. So this, even in academics, if you're like, okay, but I'm a teacher, are you going to talk about teaching? Well, you have other resources for that. So no, we're not going to talk a lot about teaching as such. But if we say that mistakes are proof that you are trying. And I see that all the time. And I think that from what we're seeing in Brené's book, that is something that that aligns with what we're studying. But what is your response when students make a mistake? And you watch that, I think you can really see, like, how is the culture in my classroom? Do students have the ability to take off their armor when it comes to making academic mistakes? And just because you know yourself and you know what kind of person you are, who you think you are, does not mean that you get automatic credit because you are their teacher and that you can expect everybody to behave as though you have the best of intentions, because they don't really know you yet until you're vulnerable with them, until they get to know you. So that first day of school, if somebody, you know, shoots their mouth off at you and gives you attitude, yeah, you do have to be able to manage your classroom effectively, but you also have to get curious. You have to not take it personally. And you have to be like, I wonder what's going on here. I wonder what previous experience this kid has that's making them respond this way, instead of being like, how can they do this? You know, I didn't do anything. All I've done, and because teaching is, I don't think it should be, but it can be a thankless job to where you give and you give and you give, and you spend all this money that they don't even know about, and you spend all this time that they don't know about, and then they hate your activity and you're like, oh, I kind of just like, watched a season on Netflix instead of, you know, doing all this to get curious and to not assume that, that this is about you.
Yeah.
So all of that is much to explore.
Yes.
And fortunately for us, our next part is Rumbling with Vulnerability. So we can really dig into the nuance and learn along with you. Just as a reminder, for this podcast, you are welcome to use the podcast as a preview, as a processing review, or maybe this is just you want to listen to the podcast and maybe you'll read the book later or at some other time. It is up to you. Just kind of know what you want to get out of it and then go in there with that mindset. The audiobook for part one is about 45 minutes. And if you're reading the current published book, of course, as new editions come out, page numbers change, but it's 24 pages in the first edition. So until next time, my hope for growth is that I can have more courageous conversations, particularly about race, that I can support my peers and the people that I work with and encounter that are dealing with racism right now. And I can not just have what's in my mind and in my heart for myself, but that I actually am courageous with those feelings and with that mindset, that I do something instead of just believe something. What about you, Tabitha?
Yeah. I think personally that the second thing that she mentioned, of the three that we're aiming for, self-awareness and self-love matter. I think that really encapsulates my hope for myself. So self-awareness links to recognizing my own privilege and how it has affected my choices and my worldview, and just being aware of that and making sure that I am learning what I need to learn and using my experiences to help others. And then self-love, just remembering to treat myself with the same kindness that I treat my own friends and my coworkers and my students.
Aw, I love that. Like, if you wouldn't treat Elizabeth that way, you can't say it to yourself.
That's right.
So we have a call to action for you. You can either define, and of course there's no homework, it's not like we can come to your house and check on you. You can either define your hope for next time or your hope for reading, or we have this specific one that you can choose. So Brené Brown talked about one of her study subjects about those 10 behaviors that get in the way of courageous leadership, and how most people thought that was a part of your personality, but that they found that it was actually something you learned. And the subject stated, "I can almost remember each lesson, how and when I learned it. If one of those 10 tendencies struck a strong chord with you, examine the heck out of that thing. Pick it, the one that's the biggest obstacle or struck you the most, and you're like, I've got to figure this out. I've got to figure out when I've learned this and how it's impacted me before I'm ready to get vulnerable. Figure out how when you learned it. Examine the credibility of the teacher or teachers of that lesson. Is that someone, whoever taught that for you, did they teach you good things? Would you teach your children or people that you are in charge of or people you serve that same lesson? If the answer is no, figure out what you can tell yourself to relearn a new pattern."
You can follow us on Facebook at Educators Who Dare to Lead. And there you will also find the release date for our next episode or just wherever you find your podcasts. And you can follow me, Tabitha, on Instagram. I am virtually Tabitha, or LinkedIn. I am Tabitha Securus.
And you can follow me. I'm Elizabeth. On Instagram, I am Elizabeth Walker Ike. Ike is spelled E-K. Or you can find me on LinkedIn under Elizabeth Ike. Again, that's Elizabeth space capital E lowercase k. Thanks for listening.